Hey there, what's going on? I'm Blaine Lay, and you're listening to Two People, a podcast about Richmond. And the idea behind the show is that each of us is really two people. So your personal self and your public self. Who you are is where the two meet. So each episode on the show, we talk to someone from around town about their personal experience and how that comes to life in the work they do. Today on the show, I sit down with Jack Barry. He's running for mayor. And Jack reflects on how his parents' example of service in Lynchburg shaped him. His mom was involved in civil rights work. His father worked in various roles in government. Jack also talks about what it was like in his early days working in the city of Richmond. He started working in the city when Henry Marsh was actually the first black mayor. We talk through a handful of issues. Jack shares his vision for what our city can be. And you'll also hear about the time when Jack drove a bus in college. So let's get into it. You're listening to episode 25 with Jack Barry. This is Two People. Well, Jack, thank you for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. Great.
Appreciate you being here. I know you're a busy man.
No, it's a fun thing to do.
Yeah, you're out and about. So you grew up in Lynchburg. Your mother was a teacher. Your dad worked in city government. What were your parents like back in the day growing up? How did they shape you?
Well, I didn't probably realize it at the time, but they really were pioneering people, and they stepped out there and were very important in improving race relations in Lynchburg in the 60s and at a very conservative time. They were very intentional about race relations. They had a lot of friends, both black and white families, that all set out to improve race relations in Lynchburg. And it was not unusual at all for African-American families to be in my home for dinner and for us to go to dinner at a home of a black family. My mother had an art class in her basement. I think it was like every Monday night. And it was an integrated art class in the basement of our home. It was mostly, I think, about women drinking wine and having fun. But that was unusual in Lynchburg in the 60s. And I mean, I didn't realize it at the time that it was unusual because I was just a kid. But looking back on it, that was a big deal. My mother was the first white teacher to volunteer to teach in an all black elementary school. And that was groundbreaking, too. You know, didn't think that much of it at the time. I just remember her coming home and telling stories about, you know, how the toilet seats were too high and she was going to fight City Hall and the school board until they fixed them. It was always a battle. But, you know, my father was also very involved in improving relationships in the city at that time.
Did he work in social services?
Yeah, he had various jobs. He was a deputy city manager. He ran the airport. He was important in the transit system and in social services. So he ended his career in social services department. He was involved in a firewood ministry with a bunch of guys.
Firewood?
They would chop firewood and take to the homes of poor individuals who used fire heat their homes.
Okay.
This is a long time ago.
They would go out, chop firewood, and bring it to people.
Wow. Yeah. So, and that all grew into a ministry that was focused on affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And my mother ended up working for a nonprofit, Lynchburg Covenant Fellowship, that was all about affordable housing. And they had a day camp that I worked at, and I ended up being directing a backpacking camp for urban kids. So, growing up in Lynchburg, it was an interesting time. There were a lot of people that related to Lynchburg College that were fairly liberal and were trying to do important things in Lynchburg during that time and period. And, you know, looking back on it, it was important work that they did that I probably didn't really appreciate at the time.
Yeah, it's something that while it's happening, you probably don't have the distance because it's just what you do. It's the water you swim in.
Right, exactly.
And it's only in retrospect that you can say, wow, that was a little different.
Yeah.
The way we're doing things.
Yeah. And so you look back on it and you say, well, how do you use that? And it's a lot of moving a city forward is about establishing personal relationships and working on things together. I think that's when you really move forward and unite a community, is when you're working on things together. And it could be, you know, a Habitat House. It could be, you know, a sports team that you're coaching. There's so many ways to work together. And that's what I think I learned from them and like to do more of.
Sure. And I think you have to work at that too.
Yeah, it's got to be very intentional about it.
We're particularly just across racial, vocational lines that I think we're increasingly sorting ourselves. People move into neighborhoods that are like them, which is natural.
Right.
So I think to work together across some of these things that divide us, you got to be a little bit creative and try to find those spaces, I think.
Right. And you see that happening in this neighborhood, in North Churchill. People are doing that in an intentional way.
Were you involved in public life, like high school, college years? Like, did you ever run for office? What did that look like when you were coming of age?
No, I saw my father, as a, you know, public servant in Lynchburg city government, and I always admired what he did. I was always interested in what he did. I followed him, you know, in the newspapers, and, somewhere along the way just figured that would be an interesting thing for me to do. So, but I was never, you know, active in politics in college or ran for anything.
Where'd you go to school?
So I went to the University of Virginia.
Okay.
Got an undergraduate degree in government. Drove a transit bus to pay for beer.
Wait, you drove a transit bus?
Yeah.
Wow. What was that like?
Oh, that's pretty cool. We're not talking about a school bus here. We're talking about a transit bus on a route.
Right. You're just driving and whoever gets on your bus.
Right. Okay. And it was a transit system owned by the University Transit Service. So it was serving mostly college kids at UVA. And eventually I got to the point where I, you know, was a supervisor and I skipped my graduation of college, even though my parents had come and my now wife's parents had come from Dallas. I skipped my graduation because I was working that day, supervising the transit service for the graduation exercises.
Did you have to, are there any memories that stand out from your bus route?
Well, back then you could put as many people on the bus as you wanted and you didn't have to worry about standing behind the yellow line and nobody had to be seated. And there was a time when I had so many people on the bus that I was rounding a curve and the crowd just kind of fell on me and lady sat on the steering wheel of my bus and I almost hit a telephone pole. But, I think back about that and think, wow, I was not as safe as I should have been.
Right.
And I drove too fast and the consequences could have been awful. But I was a college kid and I didn't have an accident.
Yeah. You made it work and now you're here.
Yeah. Right.
Great. I want to ask just about your public life here in Richmond. I mean, you were a man that over time has dedicated a lot of energy hours to public service. And it's almost a who's who of organizations, to name a few: Children's Museum Board, Leadership Metro Richmond Board, United Way, Salvation Army. You involved in Richmond 2015 with the bike race. At one point you were Virginia's Public Administrator of the Year, younger than 35. Where does your passion for community service come from?
Oh, I just like to be involved with people and making things happen. I love city government. I love local government. I like the challenges that come. I like the fact that it's a different challenge every single day. It's a really fast-paced world of working with the community to make things happen. It's also working in city government. It's also working for a large corporation.
Mm-hmm.
So you're involved in all the business systems that make a city government work that a lot of people just take for granted, like whether it's an information technology or purchasing or vehicle maintenance. It's a large, complex system that's a lot of fun to operate in, along with literally thousands of other employees.
Right.
So I started out as a budget analyst. You know, I was just thought of myself as a young gun budget analyst.
Yeah, here in the city of Richmond, right?
In the city of Richmond. We'd work long hours, and I'm still close friends with the people that I work with in the early 1980s, mm-hmm. some of whom have come back to help me on my campaign, because we were a family of people that worked really hard and loved the excitement of city government and loved to try to make things happen.
What were some of the challenges working in the city back then? Because you were also deputy city manager, chief of staff for the city. But over that window of time, Richmond, for those that have moved here more recently, is probably a different Richmond. What were some of the challenges that you were working through during your time at City Hall?
Well, the racial situation was quite different back then. It was a time when, for the first time, African-Americans were in power in city government. I was actually hired on the day that the new black majority on city council fired the white city manager and installed a black city manager. And that was a really interesting time to be there. It was an expression of black power that had been denied to African-Americans in this town for so long.
Legally. And in the 70s, it was essentially frozen for years.
Frozen for years while it went through court cases. The annexation trial went through years of court battles. So it was a time when black leadership was asserting itself and taking its rightful place in city government. So it was a really interesting time to be there. And you know, it was just an exciting time. We had a very bold mayor, the first African-American mayor, Henry Marsh. Mm-hmm. He was called King Henry at times. He didn't hold back. And I loved working in that environment because I respected bold leadership, even though it didn't sit well with everybody in town. He tried to do some important things to improve the economic development of the city at a time when we were losing ground on so many fronts. This was a time of rapid suburbanization as people left the city, gave up on the city, thought downtown didn't matter anymore. Whites were fleeing in droves. Businesses were fleeing downtown. Retail was fleeing downtown. In those days, we had anchor department stores that attracted shoppers from throughout the region and even as far as North Carolina.
So this is Miller and Rose
and Tallheimer's. They would come to Six and Broad to shop from North Carolina. It was amazing looking back to think that would have ever existed, but it did. And there was a valiant effort to save the retail core of downtown. And it didn't work. It blew up. Lots of things don't work. But you keep trying, and Sixth Street Marketplace was one of those things that the leadership then. I was just a junior budget analyst at the time, kind of watching. But then later in my career as a deputy city manager, I tried to save Sixth Street Marketplace from ruin, and it was impossible to do because it was a failed project from the get go. And then even later in my career at Richmond Renaissance, I was one of the strong advocates for tearing it down and leaving it behind and starting fresh and putting the streets back the way they were. And look at Broad Street now. It's thriving.
Yeah. And that's such an interesting story to me because I think a lot of folks think of Jack Barry, particularly someone like me who's relatively new to town in the last 10 years. He's the Venture Richmond guy that did the folk festival. That's great. But the fact that you were there on the ground and seeing... You were downtown when it was starting to become hollowed out. So it sounds like a lot of the work that you've done to say, hey, this is a great place, was informed by some of those early days seeing that.
Yeah, it was a really tough time. At one point, Richmond was, one of the murder capitals of the country. People were really giving up on Richmond. It was a valiant effort to save some of the major office tenant users who also were attracted to the counties. Nobody wants to be in a downtown that's crime-ridden and dirty. And that was the situation that we had. And turning all that around was really important and hard work and took a lot of years. People take for granted the fact that we have a downtown now that's vibrant. That's certainly... wasn't the case at one point in time. And so when I look back over a, 30-some year career and think about all the people in the business community and in local government that kept working on it, didn't give up and kept going and kept trying things and were determined to make it clean and safe and vibrant and determined to attract office tenants and determined to get the residential development started. You shouldn't take that for granted. There's a lot of hard work that went into that. I mean, I can remember when Robin Miller did his first residential project, which was basically a townhouse on Gray Street. Mm-hmm. And we were celebrating the fact that somebody was putting an apartment in downtown Richmond. And, right. and Mark Marriage, another one of the really early pioneers who started doing apartments before it was cool.
Would this have been in the 90s, early 2000s?
Yeah, early.
Somewhere in there.
Somewhere in there. Because I came back from Hanover in 1998 and worked at Richmond Renaissance from that point forward on downtown development. And we would celebrate every time there was an apartment project, we would celebrate it and market it and promote it and do tours of it and convince people that right. this was an okay place to live. Because once you get people living downtown, everything else starts right. to work better too. Eyes on the street, the sidewalks are active. There's some demand for retail. It's a safer place where people are paying attention and the restaurants and bars obviously do better. So yeah, that wasn't the case, in 2000. And now it's just made a complete turn. So mm-hmm. it really is gratifying to a lot of the people that worked on that, including some of the early developers who took big risks.
Yeah.
Got paid off because they were right.
They made some money, but they also made a bet.
They made a bet. That's what developers mm-hmm. do. They make bets, and they made a bet on Richmond. And some of the major corporations made a bet on Richmond, too. SunTrust could have left. Media General could have left. They stayed and invested downtown. And Dominion has invested big time mm-hmm. downtown. New Market invested mm-hmm. big time downtown. Mm-hmm. Altria. It would have been easier for them to do these projects in the city, in the counties.
Right.
And they didn't. And they kept the employment base strong downtown. And of course, VCU invested mightily in downtown. And all of that worked, finally.
Yeah. And that's so interesting because when you think about a part of developing the urban core, you need to have businesses there. And some businesses have left. But when you think about some of the ones you just rattled off, you don't think about the ones that could have left but are still here. So thank you, businesses, for staying here and sticking around.
Oh, no kidding. You need an employment base to make everything else work, to make the hotels work, to mm-hmm. make the restaurants work, to make the residential work. Because these people that are living downtown, many of them are working downtown. And that's why they're there. They want a walkable neighborhood. They don't want to be so automobile dependent. Downtown is one great big mixed-use community. And every element of that is important, not just the office and the residential, but the civic uses, the cultural uses. Mm-hmm. That's why if it were up to me as the head of Venture Richmond, the downtown advocacy group, I'd have everything down there.
Right.
I tried to get the Children's Museum to move downtown.
Let's get it all downtown.
Right. That's what downtowns are for. They should be dense, urban, eclectic places.
Yep. So I want to ask about your time that you spent as the administrator in Hanover. What made you want to move from jumping from the city to working out in Hanover?
I just wanted the top job. I'd been the number two guy under Robert Bob, the best city manager in America. Incredible experience working with him. Total superstar.
What made him great?
Oh, he was passionate. He was a risk taker. He had incredible energy. He could see the big picture. He cared about the details. He was all about providing services really well. Mm-hmm. A true professional in every sense. He's really one of my idols. When he was running the Detroit Public Schools, and when he was the emergency administrator of the Detroit Public Schools and had a bodyguard, it was so dangerous, the work that he was doing, and because of the decisions he was making. If I were unattached, I would have gotten in a car and driven out there to work for him,
right.
just because he was doing some of the most important work being done in America. Mm-hmm. And I've always believed in him. He just endorsed me, by the way. But so I just really enjoyed working with him.
But then you wanted the top job in Hanover.
I wanted the top job mm-hmm. in Hanover. I wanted the top jobs somewhere, and he wasn't going anywhere. And I wanted to be the CEO of a municipal corporation. Didn't know a lot about Hanover. It was an ex-urban community, outside of Richmond. So I took a shot at it, and I just applied for it like anybody else. And I think I was 39 at the time and got the job and had a great time working out there. A lot of just really great people. We worked on rural preservation. We worked on issues of growth, including utility infrastructure, road infrastructure, schools that were constructed. It was about managing growth and keeping the rural character of the community and not just becoming another faceless suburb.
Right.
So it was a fun...
How do we make sure we're still Hanover?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. For example, when we were deciding which color the street signs should be, and I advocated that they be a different color than green just so they wouldn't look like Enrico. I lost that battle, by the way. But I wanted Hanover to be special and different. And it has become that. They have an urban growth boundary, just like Portland, basically, where they concentrate the suburban-style growth in an urban corridor, and that's where they provide the utilities. And they try very hard to keep what's rural, rural, so that you see the historic character of the community expressed in many different neighborhoods. And I lived in Doswell on a little farmette, with a pond and a horse pasture. For a while, and then we decided that was not for us. Too much work and too far out, and we moved to Ashland, to a historic house in Ashland. But I love my time in Hanover.
Didn't you get a bond referendum done to fund school construction?
Yeah. So in counties, you can't issue debt without voter approval.
Okay.
And so we put together the largest bond referendum in the history of the county to support schools. And made an incredible campaign throughout the county to get that approved. And the only way you can get something like that approved is you've got to get everybody aligned. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got to agree. You can't have, a 4-3 vote and get something like that approved by the voters, particularly if it comes with a tax increase. So a lot of what we did was get everybody aligned.
Did you get any pushback on it?
Yeah, because... there are people that don't like change, and there are people that don't want their taxes going up.
Right.
But people believed in schools. So we didn't have Fortune 500 companies in Hanover other than, all we had was like King's Dominion. We didn't have big taxpayers. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a big corporate base. So the economic driver in Hanover was schools. If you have the best schools in the region, and we did, highest test scores in the region, I think they still do. People will come. And the people that are there already will thrive because their children will be successful. And so it was all about the schools. It was the priority. And I had a very close working relationship with the superintendent of schools, Stuart Robertson. I knew all the school board members. We worked closely together all the time. Anytime there were surplus funds, the first thing I did was say, okay, what two or three things can we do to make our schools better with this extra money? And then we, borrowed heavily to renovate these schools. So I want to bring some of that to Richmond and try to get people aligned, try to get people on the same page and try to reduce the amount of fighting that's going on over consolidation and budgets. And that was a lesson from Hanover that, you really work all the time to communicate with people and get them aligned.
And how much of the friction in Richmond is structural versus the personalities?
Yeah, it's both. It's fueled by the fact that in Richmond, the school boards are elected. In Hanover, they were appointed by the supervisor.
Gotcha.
So they were all automatically going to be teammates.
Right.
And you could pick really, really talented people. And when you have elections, you got people that maybe someday want to be a city council person. So they may be antagonistic. They march to their own drummer. They have their own constituency that elected them. It's harder. In a more politically charged environment. But that's what we've got to work on really hard is to get all these politicians who have their own ideas and their own, support systems to work in the same direction and come up with a plan that we can all embrace that renovates, builds new, and consolidates some schools and then get behind it. And I think if the community sees their leaders working together and getting behind a plan, they will then get behind those leaders, and they will then get behind our school system and come to its aid. And that's what we need, is a lot of people working in the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
And then community resources, whether it's faith-based or corporate or community or nonprofit or parents, they are much more likely to come work on these schools if they feel like they're working as part of a system where the leaders are aligned.
Yeah. And you've got, so I want to ask about education. You've got a 5-point plan up on your website. And one of the things that struck me, is this idea of the Education Advisory Council that you're talking about creating. Can you just talk a little bit about that idea and how it would come to life?
Well, I've been talking to so many people around the community, and a lot of the people I'm talking to are parents. And I've talked to a lot of teachers, and just community leaders in nonprofit organizations that impact the schools through the work they do with children or with parents, poverty issues, housing issues. It's just like for there to be a forum where more voices can be heard. There are a lot of really bright people in this mm-hmm. town that are passionate about the schools, and a really diverse group of people that have really good ideas, want to be heard, and want to be part of the solution. And they're not necessarily on the school board or in the school system or in the city government. They're folks in the community. And I'd like for there to be a way for some of these ideas and some of this passion to be channeled towards helping. There are people at Holton that may have ideas that would help Chimborazo, and vice versa. There are people in at VCU School of Education. We have one of the best schools of education in the country. How can we tap them better to come up with more ideas that move the city schools forward? So yeah. I just like to create some mechanism for more communication and more involvement. And I don't know exactly what form it would take, and it may evolve. It's not a decision-making group. It's a group that hatches ideas and mobilizes people to help.
Sure. Yep. Well, it's really interesting of how do you create a space for people to have a voice, have input, even though they might not be elected, just to give them a chance to vet ideas, think up new ideas. What if we did this?
Right. And it's really worked in other ways. You take the Folk Festival. Think of all the people we brought together, diverse interests. Mm-hmm. There are over 1,000 volunteers. But you look at the programming committee and you look at the people that run the Folk Festival, it's an eclectic, crazy mix of people from all kinds of backgrounds. And I just love bringing people together and seeing what happens. Because you get passionate people together, man, anything can happen.
Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? It's crazy, right? So, and I've been good at that. You know, when we developed the RVA branding campaign, we didn't go to one agency. It wasn't some top-down approach, corporate approach, where here's the logo, here's your tagline, now use it and pay me a license fee. It was, let's get the VCU Brand Center and the Martin Agency, the big guys, and mm-hmm. let's also get, you know, West Cary Group and JHI and Elevation, some other, let's get the best and brightest in Richmond, the most diverse group we can get, and let's see what they come up with. I would have never come up with 3 letters to brand Richmond. Right. I thought it was a dumb idea. But they convinced me it was a really good idea, so we put power behind it. And so there's nobody that knows the solution to poverty. And there's nobody in this town that knows the solution to schools. But as a community, we know a lot of the solutions. Mm-hmm. And it's a matter of bringing those people together. It's not me that's going to have the ideas. It's going to be...
How do you leverage the collective expertise?
Leverage the community.
And the perspectives.
Right. That's what we've got to do. I go to all these forums and all these debates, and people ask me what I'm going to do about poverty and or any particular issue. It's like, well, how does anybody know? If I knew the answer to that, you know, I'd be, you know, the president of the United States mm-hmm. or something. But I know I can bring a lot of really good people together that are going to have good ideas that move the ball forward. That's going to be the fun of the job.
It's such an interesting approach, because I think as someone running for elected office, I think it's very tempting to stand up and say, raise your hand and say, I have the right idea. It sounds like what you're saying is, I have some good hypotheses, but we need to get people involved so we can test these things. And I know a process that works.
Right. And it works across lots of different functional areas or policy mm-hmm. areas. It, you know, it's how you figure out how to have the best transit system. It's how you figure out how to have the best housing policy. It's how you figure out how do you tackle poverty.
And I think that was what happened with the development of the downtown master plan 8 or 10 years ago.
Exactly.
People speak in hushed tones about how rigorous that process was, where there was a legitimate desire to have everyone speak into this plan, not just as, well, we need to have some public meetings to check a box, but no, we want your ideas. We want you to write on this sheet of paper to figure out what's the best way that we think about downtown going forward.
Right. It really worked. Downtown plan, riverfront plan, that process really worked. And it wasn't just public hearings, come speak at the microphone. And it was small groups. It was sitting around tables. It was looking at maps. It was writing sticky notes on. And it was a collection of ideas that got assimilated into a plan. And everybody felt ownership of it. And now we just got to implement it. That's the part that's frustrating, is that, yeah, you can come up with ideas, but if you don't have somebody, if you don't have a city government that works, that's high performing, that can execute, it doesn't do any good to have two-way streets in a downtown plan. If you don't have somebody that's working hard every day to actually make the streets two-way.
Right.
So it's more than planning, it's execution. And that's where I think I'm going to be really good.
And how do you do that to move from we've got the great ideas to actually implementation? Because there was a Richmond Times Dispatch interview that you did. You said that it will be easy. It's going to be easy to identify both in terms of the people, the high performers and the low performers. We've got the audits. We know what we need to be. We know what needs to be done, but we haven't actually done it. So how do you move from we've got the good idea to we just need to execute against it?
Yeah, we've got lots of good ideas. We've got lots of plans. We've had lots of audits. The auditor puts out over 200 audit recommendations a year. The problem is only about 40% of them get implemented because they're not paying attention to them. And he's given us the blueprint. You just got to now you got to execute. And I think
A capacity issue?
It's a leadership issue.
Okay.
And almost everything is right. Almost every problem in any organization, it's leadership. It's like who is in charge and who is leading this department and who is coordinating these departments and who is in charge of, you know, street maintenance, and is he creative and smart and hardworking and passionate? And we got to make sure that we've got really strong leaders in all the right places. And you don't do that with some big performance audit. You do that. I mean, that's what I've done in my career, is evaluate talent and recruit talent. And I think I'll be able to size up the talent. And I think Selena Cuffey Glenn, the chief administrative officer, has probably already done a lot of that. Mm-hmm. I think she's just got one hand tied behind her back in the waning months of administration.
Right.
But I think we'll be able to move quickly on getting the right talent in the right places, because I think there are a lot of really young, passionate people and experienced older guard folks that want to come join this reform effort and want to make our city government work really well. I think we're not going to have any trouble recruiting the really good people. And I think there are a lot of good people in City Hall that just need to be brought forward.
Right.
So it's leadership, and then, you know, you get the leadership place, and then it's processes and it's technology, having the right tools. You know, we're in the dark ages in some of these departments. We don't even have a building permit system where you can make an online appointment for a building permit. That got shut down in April while they're trying to implement a new system, and it's still down. They said it would be up at the end of the summer. It's October. It's still down. How can that even be possible that the city government of the capital city of Virginia doesn't have an automated building permit system? So, yeah, it's people and it's systems and it's motivation and it's accountability. I mean, when I'm there, it's going to be a fun place to work. I'm telling you, people are going to love coming to work because we're going to be fired up and we're going to be getting stuff done. And it's not going to be some fear of some culture of fear where you're worried about making a mistake and somebody coming down on you. Because I'm going to roll up my sleeves and be in those departments with those employees coming up with things together.
Yeah. And I think that's certainly publicly one of the criticisms of the current administration is just the level of access that you don't see. Current mayor, he's not really out and about. Will you be accessible? Are we going to see you?
Oh, yeah. Everything is so tightly controlled now, and you got to go through some chief of staff or some, spokesperson.
Mm-hmm.
No, we're going to be open and available, and we're going to be communicating all over town, all the time, very accessible, transparent, because that's how you build trust, and that's how you get people to come on board. It'll be a completely different environment. I'll be out and about. I won't be riding around in a black SUV with tinted windows and bodyguards. You know, I'll be out, and people are going to know that.
Economic development. How should we think about the city's role in economic development? What's the mayor's role in that?
the mayor's role is to, you know, maximize all the economic development potential of the city, which includes, you know, the Boulevard site, includes Commerce Road, Jeff Davis Corridor down near the port, looking at maximizing all the opportunities that come, including commercial corridors and neighborhoods. It's about inward and recruitment of companies, but mostly it's about creating a vibrant city that is attractive to people. Because today, companies follow employees, and it used to be the other way around. And we've done a really good job of recruiting folks to come live here and be part of this community. Our colleges do a good job of bringing folks in, and we've done a better job as a community of retaining those kids and wanting them to live here and be part of this exciting community. And this, and we've created a creative economy that's attractive to companies. So, you know, doing things that strengthen the art scene, doing things that make this a more vibrant, walkable community, that values, you know, healthy lifestyles and outdoor recreation, all of that makes us stronger as an economic as a city, and will help us attract people that want to do startup companies and businesses that want to locate here because of the workforce that's here, the creative workforce, the innovative, you know, folks that are here. So it's the mayor's job to lead that effort. It's not just about recruiting companies anymore.
Yeah, and that's such an interesting point. I was talking to Rachel Burgess, who's at SIR, who's done all the research to really understand the demographic shifts. And I think just to reiterate what you just said, it used to be draw the businesses and the people will come. And now that's reversed, where it's draw the people, get the talent here, and the business will come because it's because it's a bustling, busy place.
If we had enough employees, Capital One would be expanding here instead of expanding in McLean, or instead of expanding in Plano, Texas. If they could had access to more talent here, they would be an even bigger presence here. I'd like to recruit some of their operations downtown, just like we did with CarMax. But yeah, it's all about attracting the talent and keeping the talent. And the talent wants to be here only if this is a vibrant, cool place.
Right. But when you do, so this is kind of the stone question, but I think philosophically, the city has, what, 61, 62 square miles that we can use for development. That's tax revenue. And you think about some of the localities with a place like Amazon down in Chesterfield, or even the places out at West Creek with Capital One. To what extent should we be providing incentives to get some of these businesses to draw the revenue? Because when you do that, there's somebody that's going to say, well, Jack, we should spend that money on schools. And they're not mutually exclusive in terms of drawing people brings in revenue. But how do you think about approaching getting incentives to draw business here?
Yeah, I think incentives are okay if you're recruiting a major employer, particularly a manufacturing employer, and to an area that needs jobs, and certainly the East End needs jobs. So I'm not opposed to incentives. I just think we're going to have to rely on them to a lesser degree in the future, because the city is just so attractive and people will want to be here, and they won't demand that you basically pay them to be here. I just think that when you do have incentives, they ought to be very straightforward, very understandable, and very transparent. So everybody knows what you're doing and can judge whether it's fair to the folks that are already here. I don't like the idea of the city getting in the restaurant business and competing against other restaurants. There are other ways to structure these deals. And they can't rely on money that may or not be available. You know, private sponsorships that are speculative, like the Redskins deal. They need to be more straightforward. And I think we're now making the list that these companies, when companies evaluate cities around the country and they have a big master spreadsheet of all these cities and all these criteria that they're looking at, we're starting to rise to the top. And that's what happened with Stone. We rose all the way to the top, competing against probably a couple hundred cities. So I think the outlook is very good for our city. If we could get, if we could have better schools and reduce poverty issues, man, this place would be on fire. This place would be blowing up.
Yeah,
we'd have housing prices like Boston.
Right.
People would just want to be here so badly. I don't think we have to compete so much against the counties or worry so much about competing with the counties anymore. We're going to get our share. We're on par with the counties. We can compete with them straight up. So we don't have to subsidize and shouldn't be subsidizing anybody that's moving within the region. We're going to get our share. The fact that CarMax decided they're going to have an outpost downtown, that could be just the beginning of other companies that want to be downtown because that's where the employees want to be.
Our doors are open.
Absolutely.
You mentioned the counties, and I think you hear this all the time, just the amount of sometimes the city and the counties operate like separate nation states. How do you think about encouraging that regional collaboration?
I mean, there's a misperception about how the counties think. And I used to be in the county, right, in one of the counties. I'm telling you, they down to their soul want to cooperate with the city. They want to be part of the city. They want to be part of the region. They want everything to work. They're not thinking in terms of what they can steal from the city. They're not thinking in terms of competition. They're thinking in terms of a stronger region, just like the city is. And the city is in a better position now than it's ever been because it's on equal footing. We don't have to have our hand out. Mm-hmm. We don't have to depend on the counties for our future well-being.
Right.
We're really strong as a city.
You just look at population. More people
move
into the city.
Yeah, more people are moving to the city. Right. So we're equal partners, and we ought to act like equal partners. But one of the things you have to do in a partnership relationship is that you have to have mutual respect. You have to listen. And you have to participate. Mm-hmm. And that means going to all the regional meetings. That means, you know, going to the planning district commission meetings. It means showing up for regional activities and listening and forming relationships and working at it really hard. And the counties want to deal with a city government that's competent,
right,
and that's professional. And it's not overly politicized or full of cronies. They just want to deal on a straight up business basis. And when we had that, for example, when I was in Hanover and Robert Bob was the city manager and we had Virgil and Lane in the counties, we made some breakthrough deals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got money flowing from Hanover County for the biotech park, for the VCU School of Engineering. That's when we did the convention center deal, which is the largest regional cooperation project in the history of Virginia. That's when we had the breakthrough water deal between Hanover and the city with Henrico supporting the transmission line. We got some really big things mm-hmm. done back then, and it was a matter of having people who trusted each other in key positions that could bring their elected officials to the table and make a deal. I think we have an opportunity to do that again. You know, the Hanover County Administrator used to work for me. We're really good friends.
Right.
The Chesterfield County Administrator, Joe Casey, that they just appointed recently, he used to work for me for 6 years. We're really close and trust each other. The Henrico guy, John Vitulkas, he used to be a budget intern in the City of Richmond budget office.
Mm-hmm.
All these guys want to work together, want to do stuff, trust each other, and that's the way you start.
Yeah, and I think some of it is, to your point, it's presence actually showing up.
Right.
Indicating goodwill, and a lot of it, too, is credibility. You know, I think it's easy for someone that lives in the city to say, come on, counties, why can't you guys just partner and be better? And I think that we have to, the city has to do a better job of being competent so that we can get credibility. It's kind of like if I'm out on the basketball court and I'm picking a team and I throw you the ball and you can't catch it, I'm right. probably not going to pick you. So how can we improve our ball handling skills, so to speak?
I think that's one of the things. I think there are some things that we could probably cooperate on in the counties. Maybe it's, you know, ball fields in the counties that help us attract regional tournaments that fill up hotels in the county and the city.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a two-way street. It doesn't always have to be focused on the city. And I think that's where you build stronger partnerships. I think it's going to be relatively easy, believe it or not, to get a ballpark deal done on the boulevard, because I think the counties are ready to do that deal if VCU and the city and the squirrels all come together. That's just one example. It's going to be harder to do regional transit because the counties, particularly Chesterfield, has this bias that their constituents don't really want it and mm-hmm. won't use it, and they're not going to subsidize empty buses.
Right.
So that's a tougher sell, but I think it can be done, and it needs to be done so that folks in the city have access to jobs in Chesterfield, and increasingly so that folks in Chesterfield have access to jobs in the city.
Yeah, and I think in a way it's how do you illustrate the proof of concept? It's almost like when the first developer came into downtown and you pulled other people and you say, hey, this thing works. What does it look like to do that for transportation? I don't have the answer. I don't know when that will happen, but I think
success breeds success.
Right.
So BRT's got to be successful. That leg into Henrico to Willow Lawn, it's got to work. Mm-hmm. We just got to hope like heck and work like heck to make BRT work. Because if it works, Henrico is going to expand it further west.
Right.
And if that works, then Chesterfield's going to say, well, why don't we have this on Midlothian Turnpike or Hall Street Road? And now you've got the beginnings of a regional transit system.
And then we say, well, we can do that.
Yeah, you know, we can do right. that. And that'll be at Chesterfield's expense. It won't be at the city's expense.
Right.
So yeah, success breeds success, and transit is an important regional initiative that we've got to really work hard on.
Yeah, and speaking of transit, do you have an opinion on where the train station would go? So there's been a conversation around this. Specifically, should we put the train station, assuming that we have one and that it's not Staples Mill? There's some folks that are advocating for putting on the Boulevard and others advocating for putting it downtown at Main Street Station. How do you think about that?
Well, I've worked as the chief proponent of downtown Richmond for the last 18 years, so I have a downtown bias. And I believe in downtown to downtown. So downtown Washington to downtown Richmond service. And Washington has multiple stations, Pentagon City, mm-hmm. Quantico, Alexandria. So there's room for more than one station in Richmond. There could be a new one, for example, at Staples Mill, as well as downtown. So that's my first preference. It's a multimodal train station that connects to BRT, connects to the Capitol Trail. It's convenient to the downtown Central Business District, where mm-hmm. a lot of the ridership is going to originate on trips to Washington. But there's an economic or environmental impact statement being done right now that's evaluating all the alternatives,
right.
including costs and feasibility. It's not easy to get through Acca Yard and the bottlenecks between there and downtown. And if that comes back and says that it's just too difficult, it's not feasible, it's too expensive to make the downtown Main Street station work the way it should for high-speed rail or higher-speed rail, then I think the Boulevard is a really intriguing opportunity. The Boulevard area is going to be our midtown. It's going to be, over the next 30 years, if you can think that far out, it's almost going to be like a second downtown for Richmond. Hmm. It's going to be an economic driver in the same way that downtown is. So I could imagine a train station there as part of that development. It's a really exciting idea. I like big ideas. I want to see the study first to see what the alternatives are and how feasible they are before I say which one I'd get behind.
So right now, Main Street's your first choice.
That's my first
choice. You're open.
Yeah.
You're open to ideas.
Just like a politician, right? A politician always gives you an obtuse answer and supports everything, right?
So, right. Exactly.
I'm keeping my options open.
When I see you, you seem optimistic, frustrated, but also filled with a lot of energy. What keeps you going?
Oh, I just love
Is
this town.
Is that accurate, first of all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I just love this town. I love to see what has happened to this town. I love to see, 30 years of work coming to something really big and important. We're making the list of some of the great cities in America now. We're not some backwater that's stuck in Civil War days.
Right.
We've obviously got challenges. We've got some neighborhoods that are not keeping up at all. We got a city government that's not keeping up. So I'm frustrated that there's so many issues that need attention, but I'm excited about the opportunity to be in the mix and bring together people to work on those issues. So I'm totally energized by this, and it's really an exciting time for me. I never thought I'd do anything like this. I've never been a politician.
And here you are.
I mean, I've never been a campaigner. I've never even thought about doing something like this, but it's definitely energized me.
Yeah. So final question, Jack, you're running for mayor. There's somebody on the other side of this recording with earbuds or driving around in their car. Why should that person vote for Jack Barry?
Because I love the city. I'm passionate about this city. I've been real successful in the things that I've done to enhance our city. I'm the one candidate in the field that has municipal government experience. I've managed large, complex organizations. I can bring people together. I can unite the community to support our schools. I love the city. I've been working to enhance the vitality of the city for a lifetime. And I think you give me 4 years, I can get this place turned on the right track. I can get people united to support schools. I can move the city forward in amazing ways if I have this opportunity.
Great. Jack Barry, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
There's
a lot of fun. Yeah,
appreciate
the
time.
There's a lot of fun.
For more info about Jack, you can check out jackbarryformayor.com. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes and lots of other podcast places. Our theme song is by No BS Brass. And Chris Payne is the sound of a wind chime jingling gently in the breeze. Thanks for listening. Yeah.